We have other people who are traveling. I know a lot of folks are camping. We've got just it seems like a lot is going on this weekend, but I'm so happy to be spending this time with you. I think someone has a birthday today. It seemed like a young Hillis, one of the young Hillis people. Kinsey, maybe? I think she's 12 now. Is that right, Kinsey? Something like that. Well, happy birthday to y'all. If y'all see Kinsey and she doesn't knock you out, tell her happy birthday. She's so sweet. Oh, no. Thrilled for her. And I just so appreciate it. I got to be honest, though, Zach did a great job with the Lord's Supper devotional, but I have been thinking about bear attacks for quite some time. Since then, I've been thinking, what would I do in that situation? And I think I've got it figured. You're in good hands, honey. Ever happens to us, I got it all taken care of. I was thinking about what a tremendous act of selflessness that would be, to lay down your safety and your security for a loved one. It's been said that you know, we have a lot of sensitive nerves in the human body, but perhaps the most sensitive is the one that runs from the base of your brain all the way down to your wallet. That is perhaps the most sensitive because, I mean, money has a significant power in our lives. I think we're all aware of that. I don't want to overhype it or anything, but I think we probably all know the power that money plays in our lives. We all come from different backgrounds. We all come from different kinds of families. We were probably all taught differently and learned different things about money. And as a result, we tend to, even as homogenous as we are, you know, all Church of Christ folks from the South gather on a Sunday morning, we have really different thoughts and understandings and perspectives about money, even together this morning. But given that money is such a major component in our lives, whether we want it to be or not, it's a big part of our lives, and it has power. It has power to help us and help other people. It has power to hurt us, power to hurt other people. The question we're kind of grappling with this morning is, how do we make money a blessing rather than a curse? If you were to go online this morning and were to start looking at searches about money and maybe to ask the question, how do you make money? Man, you are going to find literally hundreds of thousands and even millions of pages and articles telling you how you can make more money or different money or better money or how to make money that you can't even imagine. You can find articles about how to invest your money, how to manage your money, who to trust with your money. You could go to a bookstore. You could go to a bookstore or a library and you could find shelf after shelf after shelf after shelf filled with books on how to become successful and make all of your dreams come true. And that desire that we all have, that need to feel successful, right? That's permeated Christian culture as well. And so you'll find lots of Christian stuff, sermons and lessons and books and pamphlets promising you that if you'll just follow these five simple biblical principles, then everything's going to turn out for you. God's going to give you money. God's going to give you health. God's going to make your kids perfect, your marriage perfect. Everything's going to work out. We just want to be successful. Just follow these 3, 5, 10, whatever it is, simple rules. And for most of us, really the quest for money isn't even really about money. What we want, what you and I want, what we really long for and crave, isn't so much just money, it's success. We want happiness, right? We want to reach that point in life where we can sort of rest easy and say, all right, that's good. This is enough. That's the point we want to get to. That's the point you want to get to. Maybe it's a point in your career where you like reach this job you've been longing for forever, and you're like, okay, now I'm no longer just doing that. Now I have reached the pinnacle of my career. Now I can rest easy. Or maybe it's a certain amount of money coming in each week, or a certain amount of money in the bank. You're like, okay, now I can relax. My retirement is fully funded, or my house is paid off, or my income exceeds my debts, or well, whatever it is. Or maybe you're as a parent, you're like thinking, okay, if I could just get these kids out of the house and on their own, that would be the end of it, right? And so we all have these markers, these places in our life. We think, if I could just get to that place, then I could rest easy. And I would say, this is enough. As we continue our study through the book of Ecclesiastes, we kind of see that we're not the first ones to feel this way. Yes, that idea is all throughout our culture, but it's not just us, right? We're not the only ones looking around and asking, you know, how can I get a life like that? Maybe you see someone or you know someone in person or on TV or somewhere in the world, and you see their life and you see what they've got, and maybe it's a great marriage, maybe it's a great house, maybe it's a great job, but we just see, I wished I had that right there. And we are so easily and naturally drawn to the benefits of success that what we're missing is the secrets of success. Now, I don't often tell this, but I have learned the secrets of success. Now, don't go telling anybody else. These are secrets, right? But the benefits of success are really obvious. I mean, it's the person up the block who has the largest house in your neighborhood, or maybe they have the fanciest car, or they own the sleekest boat at the marina, or the nicest camper, or whatever it is you love. It's the person who has the fanciest offices on the top floor of the office building. It's the person who carries more country club memberships in their wallet than you have coupons in your purse, right? It's the person whose kids attend the very best schools while you're trying to make ends meet with your kids in the most affordable schools. It's the people who have savings accounts that look like what you're hoping to get this week on the lottery payout. You get the idea. In America, the benefits of success are super, super obvious. But the secrets of success are so much more subtle. And it lies really with this one question we're going to be focusing on today. And that is, how do we gauge success? I want you to imagine someone, and it's probably not too difficult for you to do this. I want you to imagine someone who grew up, maybe they were smaller, or maybe they had lesser physical abilities, then maybe they weren't as athletic or as big or as strong, but they're bullied for whatever reasons. They're bullied throughout their childhood because of their size or their strength or something along those lines. And so over time, they start to get this idea in their head. They're thinking, if only I could get big enough and strong enough, then I'd be safe, then I would be happy. Right? And so that idea, it goes over and over and over. I've got to get bigger, I've got to get stronger, then I'll be safe, then I'll be happy. Got to get bigger, got to get stronger, then I'll be safe, then I'll be happy. And so they spend the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years constantly trying to become bigger, stronger, better at the expense of friendships, at the expense of jobs, at the expense of family relationships. They are focused on this one thing so that they could be bigger, stronger, safer, happy. Only to realize at some point in life how big and strong and miserable and alone they are. We can spend our entire lives, our whole lives, pursuing what we believe to be success, only to achieve it and be absolutely miserable. We achieve what we've always wanted, and that's when we find out we've been playing the wrong game all along. So how exactly should we be measuring success? How do we gauge success? The book of Ecclesiastes chapter 5, we're just going to read a few verses this morning. This is verses 10 through 12. It says, the lover of money will not be satisfied with money, nor the lover of wealth with gain. this also is vanity. When goods increase, those who eat them increase. And what gain has their owner but to see them with his own eyes? Sweet is the sleep of the laborers, whether they eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not let them sleep. Always something more, isn't there? Something newer, something better, something. And so the preacher of Ecclesiastes makes this observation. He says, the more you own, the more you have that owns you, right? And if we're not careful, it's not only going to consume our waking hours or our business hours, as we like to think of them. It won't just be from 9 to 5, but it'll be from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep, if we can go to sleep. It'll even disrupt our sleep at night. Some of y'all probably have heard the story of John Paul Getty, J. Paul Getty, as he was often known. He was born in Minneapolis in 1892, was educated in California, attended Oxford University eventually. He becomes an independent oil producer in 1914, which, by the way, was a great time to become an independent oil producer. If you ever get the chance to do it, I'd recommend it. He held the presidential and directorial positions of several oil companies all through the 1930s. From 1942 to 1961, he becomes president and general manager and principal owner of Minnehaha Financial Corporation. And then in 1948, he becomes the president and principal owner of the Getty Oil Company. And from the Second World War all the way until his death in 1976, J. Paul Getty was one of the richest men in the entire world. So he started collecting art at another great time, the Great Depression. Because during the Great Depression, you could buy fine pieces of art for pennies on the dollar. So eventually, he owns one of the finest private collections of paintings anywhere in the world. He establishes the J. Paul Getty Museum on his estate in Malibu, California, in 1974. So this is a guy who has everything. I mean, he loves art, so he makes enough money to have art. He's in charge of his own career. He's got his own businesses. He has got everything. Or did he? He had, during that same time, three failed marriages, numerous other mistresses, but three failed marriages. From those three marriages, he had at least two legitimate children, speculation about multiple illegitimate children, but none of whom, all of whom, he deliberately avoided relationships with any of his kids. He had very few friends. He had very few acquaintances. Let's not even talk about friends. His business colleagues and his competitors all held him in extremely low regard because he was cold, he was calculating, he was ruthless, he was uncaring. At his death, there were very few mourners, and then once the will was read, there were even fewer. He died essentially alone, unloving and unloved. The only lasting legacy that you and I get is what we can impart to the people we love, to our parents, our spouses, our kids, our grandkids, our friends, our church family. All we have is what we can give. That's it. All we have is what we can give. Our name, our reputation, our values, how we conduct ourselves while we are living, that's it. And herein lies the secret of success that the preacher in Ecclesiastes shares in the very closing verses of this chapter. Look at verse 18. He says, "This is what I have seen to be good." Right? Ready for the secret of success? Here it is. Here's what's good. Here's what is meaningful. Here's what's lasting. It is fitting to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun for the few days of life God gives us. For this is our lot. Likewise, all to whom God gives wealth and possessions, and to whom He enables to enjoy them and to accept their lot and to find enjoyment in their toil, this is the gift of God. for they will scarcely brood over the days of their lives, because God keeps them occupied with the joy of their hearts. To labor, to toil under the sun, he says, this is a noble endeavor. To work with our hands, to learn a craft, to build a business, build a home, to be a mother, to be a father, to be watch your kids grow up, to watch your grandkids grow up, to be involved in their lives and help build human beings, to do all those things. Those are noble aspirations. Those are good things. But whatever your aspirations may be, whatever they are, we have to find fulfillment in them. To work hard, to hone our skills, to become a better employer or employee or worker or manager or whatever it is, to become better at that, to take advantage of our God-given talents, that brings a twofold reward. Because not only does it bring purpose and meaning to our lives, but it provides for the greater good, and eventually it glorifies God when we do it the way it ought to be done. What he says is the pursuit of excellence is rewarding. It's not wrong to want to be better, to do better. It's not wrong to want to achieve for to the best of your ability. We should take pride in our accomplishments without becoming prideful. We should enjoy the fruits of our labor without becoming hoarders of them. One of the best most beloved couples that I've ever had the privilege of getting to know in my life. They were members of a church that we worked with when I was younger, even all the way back to college. And they weren't boastful or prideful, but they served and gave of themselves in really every possible way. Time, energy, financially, just everything they could give of themselves, they did. And they never desired to take the credit for it. They earned a great deal of money. They invested it wisely, and yet they still lived well within their means. They lived their lives comfortably. They got to travel. They had a nice house, and yet they gave sacrificially. They were in agreement that they ought to be financially supporting the church and other worthwhile organizations and endeavors, and yet, to my knowledge, they never insisted that their way was the only way. They never held their views above those of others, even though they were maybe putting more in the pot at the time. To eat, to drink, and be merry, to enjoy the fruits of our labors, that is not sinful. I don't know who has kind of driven that into the Christian mind that it was wrong to enjoy the fruits of our labors, but the writer of Ecclesiastes says no. It's good. You enjoy rebuilding a card. And by the way, don't look at Rob Clutter's Facebook post. Gratuitous nudity in there. Just shameful. But if you enjoy rebuilding cars, there's nothing wrong with enjoying rebuilding cars. You enjoy working out in the yard and making a nice garden. God bless you. That's okay. Throw a picture up on Facebook and show those vegetables or those flowers you've got going. You enjoy building cabinets, or you enjoy playing with your kids. If you enjoy those things, that's great. God desires that we live our lives to the fullest. The unfortunate thing is that we, as normal human beings, often struggle telling the difference between what's healthy and what's harmful, between what's adequate and what's excessive, between what's productive and what's destructive. We have trouble drawing that line. It isn't wrong for us to enjoy what we have accomplished. It isn't wrong to want to make or do better. What's wrong and destructive is not practicing contentment where we are right now. So we're just going to do something real quick. Just put your hands down. I want you to think about your exact situation. And you can think about all that you wished was different about it. Maybe it's your health or your finances or some relationships. We can all do that, by the way. But think about the ways God has blessed you right where you are right now. Think about the ways God has been working in and through your life right where you are right now. And we need to take that measure of contentment, because here's the secret. If we aren't practicing contentment right where we are right now, then we're never going to be content when we get what we want. Does that make sense? If you can't be content where you are, you're not going to be content where you're going. That's what he's saying here in Ecclesiastes. He says, no matter how much you have now, if you're not content with it, you're not going to be content when you get more. If you're not content with the amount of money you've got coming in and are always looking to make more money, then even when you get that more, you're not going to be content. I shared this with the elders this morning. I was listening to an interview with an actor, and he was mostly in commercials, never had a lot of success or anything, but he finally found a manager who would try to at least get him parts in some real TV shows and movies, that sorts of thing. So he finally lands a big part in a big-time TV show. And he's so excited, and he gets there, and he realized, he said, the whole time I was doing it, I was so nervous and uncomfortable, and I never knew why, because I loved the work, and I loved the people I was around, and it was a great environment, but I was never comfortable. It was because for my whole life, I'd been thinking about the next thing. What am I going to do next? What am I going to achieve next? What's the next step? And all of a sudden, I get to the very top of the staircase, and I can't just enjoy what I've achieved. I can't be content because I wasn't content along the way. Even when we get what we want, if we haven't been practicing contentment all along, we're not going to be satisfied. So the secret of success is to learn to be content, even if we still have ambitions, even if we still have drive, even if we still have dreams, but to learn to be content where we are, so that when God gets us where we're going, we'll still be satisfied. And if we can pray for you this morning, lift you up, encourage you, we want to do that now. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?